Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Footmarks podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi. You can find me at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, of course, is Jared Kimber. You can find him everywhere. And the premise of this episode in particular is the Bazball misconception. Now, Jared, whenever someone speaks about Bazball, you always have that one person who comes in and says that, oh, we've seen this before. And they're going to quote Sehwag or Gilchrist. They're going to call it Sehwag ball or Gilchrist ball. And whilst that notion is flawed on its own, and we'll get to that in a bit, you mentioned in your piece that if you're going to go down that route, you might as well call it Trumper ball, because the OG of attacking cricket in Test cricket is Victor Trumper, who was an Australian who made his debut in 1899. And amongst batters who have scored a minimum of 3,000 Test runs, his average, or sorry, strike rate is still the ninth best, which I think is remarkable. So yeah, just enlighten us on this crazy, crazy cricketer.
Yeah, I think, so Victor Trumper comes out of Sydney at that, he's got two really, really important skills. He comes out of Sydney just as the liquid manure phase of cricket is finishing up. And so batters are feeling more confident to play their shots. So without going into that, because I've probably done a million videos on it before, but essentially cricket is a bowler's game right up until about 1890. And then it becomes a batter's game. That's why when you look at W.G. Grace's numbers, you're like, why is everyone going mad about a guy who averages like 35? It's like, because everyone else is averaging, you know, 17 or 20. And Trumper comes out of that. And at that stage, Grace had opened up footwork and Ranji opens up leg side play. And what Trumper basically does is, it's very, I would assume, and we don't have enough footage of him to really be sure, but you could see it. There's a great series of photos that was done. They were staged photos. You might have seen the one with the big back lift of Trumper.
Maybe not.
It's a really famous cricket photo. If you Google Trumper, it's probably one of the first photos you see. That's a staged photo by a photographer. You can actually see that the background is fake. And obviously in those days, they didn't have the cameras to be able to film people out on the ground. But that is a series of photos. And in it, you actually get the keys to what Trumper was, which is Trumper would hit a ball from a length outside off stump over the leg side. And that was revolutionary at that point, because essentially what happened at that stage is, outside of Ranji, who players had got to the point where if the ball was down leg side, they would hit it to leg side. But if you look at footage of Grace, you'll see that Grace doesn't particularly like hitting the ball to leg side. In fact, he's not very good at it. We only have like a handful of balls that he ever faced, and they're just throwdowns. But you can actually see he looks fine outside of stump. The minute the ball's at his stumps and he's trying to flick on the leg side, he doesn't have that game. And that's because he didn't grow up batting to the leg side. And so when Ranji's a fascinating figure in all that as well, in that Ranji was afraid of the ball when he was coming up, you know, and Nepo baby, had lots of money, got a coach, you know, very similar to, I don't know, Zach Crawley or Shaun Masood type story, right? You know, they worked on him until he became a cricketer. And one of the things they did was, of course, essentially they stuck him in the crease, right? They put things behind his feet so he couldn't back away. So he had to come up with a new shot, and he comes up with the leg glance. But again, that's still hitting a ball that's already going down the leg side to the leg side, right? And if you bowled a short ball outside leg stump, people would hump it away and that sort of stuff. What Trumper does is he basically takes the balls from off stump specifically, but also outside off stump, and he whips them across to the leg side. And one of the great photos, you can actually see the ball as well. the imaginary ball. I'm not sure there was a ball in the photo, but you could see that he's closing his wrist and he's hitting over the leg side. And that is now, you know, Azza did it, Viv Richards did it, KP did it, Steve Smith did it, right? We've got lots of people who do it now, but it's still not that common for a really top player to do that. And what it did in the trumpet era, of course, is there's no fielders on the leg side because you only got fielders on the leg side for the bad ball, right? If your wicketkeeper can't keep or your bowler keeps bowling down leg side or, you know, those sorts of things. And he's just whipping this ball away. You know, the footage I've seen is probably maybe a little bit more like KP than Viv Richards, but that kind of style, a bottom hand whipping the ball away. And because of that, he scores at an incredible rate, right? On top of that, he's just a powerful guy. He's not very big, but he's got incredible timing. I remember one of my favorite stories is he owned a cricket shop in Sydney and Aubrey Faulkner came over. And you remember, there's like three great cricketers in the world. It's, you know, Victor Trumper, Aubrey Faulkner and Sid Barnes. And Aubrey Faulkner is in awe of Victor Trumper. And he asked for a bat. And so Victor Trumper gives him a bat. And Aubrey Faulkner gets the bat and he goes out and plays. And he's like, oh God. It's a bad bat. He's given me a bad bat and he uses it a few times. He's like, oh, I don't know. So he goes back to Victor Trump and goes, I'm really sorry, but the bat you gave me is not quite great. And Victor Trump is like, oh, I'm so sorry. And he takes it and smashes the ball everywhere with it. That's the difference between a guy who can average over 40 in Test cricket and what Victor Trump was. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think their batting averages were about the same in Test cricket. But the impact. So I think there's another game where Aubrey Faulkner makes 200 and Victor Trumper just comes out and smashes like 169 of 168 balls or something like that. Like just things that just didn't happen in Test cricket. It wasn't how it was played. People were still getting used to, you know, the ball bouncing more and all these other things and the pitchers getting better. And Victor Trumper is explosive. There's a game that I think it might be a Sydney club game where he breaks some sort of world record for the fastest scoring ever, but he does it I think it's like runs per minute he breaks in this game. I can't remember the full details. So I didn't look it up for this particular piece. But I remember in it, every time you hit a six, you had to swap ends, a bit like backyard cricket, right? It was a really weird sort of rule that they had. And he was still scoring quicker than anyone else did. And there's another game where a guy in Sydney club cricket switches teams. And he said, oh, when I used to bowl to Trumper in the nets, I used to destroy him. And so Trumper, who was a very mild, you know, humble, you know, hero, especially, you know, coming off Grace, you know, he was much more in the, you know, Grace and Barnes were the big figures and Faulkner and Faulkner and Trumper were much more humble in that sort of way. But when Trumper found out that someone was saying, it's a bit like, you know, when, you know, in the NBA games, when someone calls themselves the Jordan stopper and Jordan will try and put 50 points on them, that's what Trumper did. But the ability to score so quickly was just absolutely incredible. And, you know, you talked before of his strike rate. We know it's the ninth quickest strike rate in cricket, but we don't know how. It's only from about 1,400 balls, and we know he would have faced more balls than that. So that's probably about half of his career. And also, when I looked it up, it's the stuff I have, and there are other people who have more. I don't think anyone has all of his strike rate, but I think there are people that have more. But the back half of his career, he actually slows down. Well, right, not the back half, the right at the end, he slows down because he's just not the player that he used to be. My guess is that that 69 is low and he probably scored around 75 to 80, sort of Quinton de Kock, Sehwag, Gilchrist type level of scoring in an era where people were still scoring at strike rates of 20, 25, 30. You know, quite rare. You know, there was a lot of Craig Brathwaite's and Dom Sibley's out there. So to put Trumper in there, and it's why, so Trumper was thought of, even when Bradman came through, Trumper was still thought of by some people as the better bat. And it was because of the explosive nature that he had. Also, the other thing that he had, which was absolutely brilliant, was he could score on wet wickets. And wet wickets, you go through, I don't know if you saw the video I did from Old Trafford about teams coming back from 2-0 down in three test series, right? In that, I was talking about the fact that Bradman basically couldn't score on wet wickets. Like, it just, you know, just wasn't his thing. It wasn't how he batted. He was very much a hard wicket player. Whereas Trumper was good on both. And in fact, would practice on wet wickets. He would go out in the middle and he would wet a wicket to practice on it. Now, that is dangerous, right? Because the ball is going to come up at all sorts of angles. It tells you the sort of player he was. But he ends up averaging, I don't know, 42, 43, I'd have to look it up. It's somewhere low 40s anyway. And yet people are still saying a generation later that he was as good as Bradman. He wasn't, right? But you can understand why if you saw him in full flight, why you would have thought to yourself, well, this is something else, right? This is something that we haven't ever seen before. And we'd certainly seen powerful players before. We'd seen skillful players before. We'd probably just never seen the two of those things combined into a top-line batter who could score at double the rate of everyone else.
Yeah, no, those are some great anecdotes. Anyone who did not know about Victor Trumper, they're surely going to be Googling him now. And those are some lovely stories. And even if we look at the English side, right? Same era, pre-World War, another cricketer who debuted in 1899 was Gilbert Jessop. And this is a guy who, till this day, holds the record for fastest test 100 by an Englishman, which I think is amazing. Mm. And we've seen other players from England come, you know, throughout the years. Ian Botham is one that comes to mind who used to give it a proper whack. You've got your Flintoffs and your KPs. But clearly, you know, attacking cricket predates baseball by over 100 years. And to imply that it has, you know, some sort of crossover, or well, it does have some sort of crossover, but it's the same thing to imply that it's the same thing as baseball, in which a team is doing this en masse.
Yeah.
I think that is a bit ludicrous.
Yeah, and I think that's why, I mean, my bigger thing was originally, as a historian, getting annoyed when someone's like, well, Sehwag invented attacking batting. I was like, well, I mean, Gilchrist was right there at the same time. So, and then someone else would say, Gilchrist invented it. And then someone else would say, Viv. And I was like, well, wait a minute. These guys aren't the inventors of baseball, and they also aren't the inventors of attacking cricket. So Gilbert Jessop is probably a player that I would say has existed all the way through the game. So I think Trumper was perhaps one, you know, the original sort of attacking top order player who could make runs and score very, very quickly. And I think that Gilbert Jessop is probably more, you know, I could name a bunch of them. There's Jimmy Sinclair from South Africa, who was an all-rounder, who gave it a big whack. George Bonner gave it a big whack. Then you've got Gilbert Jessop. Leary Constantine is another one. You know, you probably heard Keith Miller. Garfield Sobers was probably more a proper batter, but when he wanted to, had that power. Kapil Dev, you know, Richard Hadlee, you know, Ian Botham, all these. There's a lot of all-rounders and middle-order sort of players who had the ability to just come in and whack the ball and would do it all the way through history. And again, it's a bit reductionist to think that, like, you know, attacking batting starts with Virendra Sehwag. I mean, I think one of the more interesting ones from that, from my perspective, is Kapil Dev, because Kapil Dev's strike rate, I think, is what, second or third highest of all time. And you're talking about a guy who played, you know, in the 80s. And you've got Viv Richards, who Viv Richards is kind of the next level of Trumper. You know, again, well, so much faster than everyone else of his generation, but also he was an even better bat than Trumper. He averaged more runs and had more of an impact than Trumper did. Don Bradman had a really good strike rate as well. I think Don Bradman's strike rate was 66 or something. So in his era, you know, he was, and that's because, you know, he could hit every ball for a single whenever he wanted to. You know, he was that much better than everyone else. It wasn't that he was attacking in the way that we would see modern attackers. And I suppose, you know, I picked Gilbert Jessop to point out that if you watch an England game now and, like, Harry Brook is like 80 or, you know, 70 balls, so people start to go, oh, he's getting close to Gilbert Jessop's record. But the truth is that Gilbert Jessop, even through baseball, has held that record. He even held it through Botham, who I think had three of the top seven quickest scoring hundreds of all time. Those players have existed. But I do think there is a fundamental difference between the, you know, Leary Constantine from the West Indies coming in at number seven and whacking the ball everywhere. And Viv Richards and Trumper doing it, right? So, you know, Kapil Dev... This is a very weird anecdote, but I was an all-rounder. And I think as an all-rounder, it allowed me to always attack very hard when I batted, because I knew I was probably going to be a frontline bowler. Worst case scenario, I'm going to bowl three or four overs. Probably, you know, on bad days, in the old days, I used to bowl 25 and 30 over spells, right? You know, as a spinner. So I knew I was going to be in the game even if I failed with the bat. And if I was going to bat, I was going to bat my way. Well, since I've injured my arm, I can barely bowl now. And when I do bowl, I'm in pain and it's horrible. And, you know, as my shoulder comes back slowly, maybe I'll be able to bowl properly again. But my batting has completely changed. I played in a 20-over game recently and I left a ball. Like, I didn't used to leave a ball in 80-over games, like, let alone in 20-over games. And so we do, I think there has to be an understanding that, you know, Kapil Dev or Constantine or Gilbert Jessop and those sorts of guys are a different, you know, both of them and, you know, Lance Cairns, you know, Chris Cairns probably as well. Those sort of guys have a freedom, right, that other batters do not have, right? You know, the whole Gilchrist thing of Gilchrist, everyone said Gilchrist could have been a specialist, but I think in Gilchrist's mind, he knew that that was his optimal, because his technique wasn't quite as solid as other players with his kind of record, right? That's why his average actually starts to slip, because eventually people work out, wait a minute, when he's not hitting us for six, we could just, you know, come around the wicket and dry him up a little bit, or we can bowl with two gullies and he's going to keep slashing and we might eventually get him out that way. You know, top batters are a little bit different to that sort of thing. So there is a freedom there. So again, we have had very attacking players all the way through, but I do think there's a big difference between Trumper, Sehwag, and Viv Richards compared to some of the other players that were very attacking. But to say that we didn't have players who would come in and whack it, it's just not true.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And you mentioned quite a few names over there of players who had been employing that attacking cricket sort of mindset over the years. Viv Richards kind of stands out, though, because in his era, he was a cut above, and the rate at which he was playing, you could make an argument that he kind of changed cricket forever, because everyone who came after him, you know, that was the sort of template that, okay, he's way ahead of his time. So would you say that the impact that Bazball is having at large maybe is somewhat similar to the micro influence that Viv Richards on his own had on batting as a whole?
No, I think Viv Richards is probably more similar to Jeff Thompson or Shane Warne. Maybe Murali is another one, where they have an influence in that I think people start to go, well, you can put pressure back on. But also there's a certain point where they decide, but we don't have a Viv Richards. Right. So you do start to see players like Kim Hughes come through. I'm trying to think of some of the other sort of slightly more dashing players come through. But I think they understand the influence that Viv Richards can have, but also that, you know, Viv Richards is kind of one. Like even Gordon Greenidge, who was quite attacking, is not on that kind of level. Right. So I don't think I went through it. Oh, no, I might have gone through it in the piece, you know, and I know we'll come to Australia later, but you look at the strike rates of players who are thought to be attacking from other eras. So I think Michael Slater is a perfect example of that, of someone who's thought to be attacking. And you look at his strike rate now, no one would call him attacking, right? At that stage, he was still a little bit, he still had an impact in the way that Michael Slater played. But looking back on it, you're just like, well, that's nothing. Whereas you look back on Viv Richards and his strike rate was, you know, double what other top order players were of his era. And I think from that perspective, it allowed people to understand what they could do. But the truth is, mate, that no one did it in Test cricket and no one even did it in One Day cricket. He stands out with strike rate in both. And I think that he is certainly someone that when you look at his strike rate compared to other players of his era, it's impossible not to factor in that he had such a huge advantage over everyone else. I saw this spell. And he never made, this is a weird one about Viv Richards. He never made runs against Richard Hadley, right? Against New Zealand at all. I don't think it's a Richard Hadley thing. I haven't gone back to see how many times Hadley got him. But he just never made runs against New Zealand, which is weird because he whacked everyone, right? But he really struggled against New Zealand. But there's one game that was in New Zealand and he goes in early and there's Hadley's on one. And he's taken a wicket and Viv Richards goes out. And I think Viv Richards hits him for four fours in that over, right? And Hadley, the most immaculate line and length bowler we've ever seen, you can see him in shambles, right? He doesn't know what to do, right? Because this doesn't happen to Richard Hadley. And if you want to go forward years later, KP doing the same thing to Glenn McGrath, right? Of, wait a minute, what? You know, and we saw Brian Lara do it to Shane Warne as well. When guys can score at that kind of rate against you, it completely mixes up all your plans. And I think that you make a solid point that, you know, what Viv Richards did should have been influential. But I don't think it is, because the strike rates don't go up after that in any meaningful way. The only thing that really changes strike rates in Test cricket up until the Bazball, really, and what Australia did in the late 90s, early 2000s, is One Day cricket. Like, I think there's a bit of a jump in One Day cricket. But I will just say this, if you do go back to strike rates, I think the strike rates in Trumper's era were, that was one era, and I think it was up until World War One. There wasn't as much cricket being played, but in that, whatever it was, 9-year period before the war, they actually scored, there was quite a few players, you know, because there was Sinclair and Jessop and Trumper, there was actually a slightly faster scoring era before, but realistically, it never stayed. And the reason is it is better to, if you want to make lots of runs in Test cricket, it's better to be slightly defensive. That's been the truth for almost everyone, except for a handful of people up until, you know, the last year and a half.
Yeah, fair enough. And that's quite interesting, actually. I would have never known that that would have happened right before the First World War. You spoke in your piece, or wrote in your piece, that Viv Richards might have been the first player ever to combine average with strike rate. Now, another guy who did this really, really well and also sits at the top of the pile for batters with minimum 3,000 test runs and, you know, highest strike rate, that is Virender Sehwag. Yeah. And a lot of people have called this Sehwag ball, this and that. And anyone who's watched Sehwag play, I mean, they'll know exactly what they're talking about. But again, he was the only player in that Indian team who was pretty much doing this up until maybe Dhoni came along and this and that. It wasn't a team of Sehwag, so it's still different to Bazball. And I think he would have really enjoyed playing in this unit that Stokes and McCullum have built.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the more interesting things for me is if you look at Sehwag, his style, it was very un-Indian, right? India and Australia had become the two best test batting nations by the time Sehwag had come along. And I mean that over a long period of time, you know. Conditions play a big part in this. Especially first innings pitches in Australia and India really helped the local batters. They're also, you know, at a certain point, I think it was in the 90s, you know, the average runs per wicket in India was just absolutely off the chart. And it wasn't just the home players. Even the away players were at that point were doing really, really well. And it was a conservative place. You know, Sachin was, even in one day cricket, as exciting as he could be, they weren't Sri Lanka, right? They weren't Gilchrist and Moore. They were a different version of all that sort of stuff. And it, you know, you've got Rahul Dravid batting around you, right? Like, you know, you definitely have a position there where you are, what's the best way of putting it? Everyone is thinking about making as many runs as possible. And this bleeds into Sehwag's white ball career, because Sehwag is seen as a white ball failure by a lot of people. And as I think if you go back with modern eyes, you'd be thinking he might have been one of the greatest players of white ball cricket ever, because he only averaged 30 to 35, whatever it was, in one day cricket. But he did it at a strike rate that was ridiculous. But we didn't look at it that way back then. Everyone else was averaging 45, 50, 55, right? So it was like he didn't work. But for Sehwag to do that in that era, I think it's just, you know, it was a disruptive force. And I do think that while the IPL obviously has had an impact on some of the other Indian players coming through, I do think that it probably freed the minds of Indian batters. But you mentioned MS Dhoni. So Dhoni averages 38 in Test cricket. He was, again, a very good player. That's seen as a failure, because I think we thought he could have averaged deeper more. But his strike rate is 59, right? And that is fine. A strike rate around 60 suggests that you are an above average, speed of scorer in Test cricket. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change the needle, right? It doesn't change the test. It's really, I've said this a lot, until you get to 70, 75, there isn't that much of a difference between someone who strikes at 50 and 55 and 59, right? There just isn't, you don't feel those runs. Once you get to, you know, 60, 65, 70, you're starting to get to the point where it's like, you know, you're scoring so much quicker than an average batter, you are starting to feel it. So for Sehwag to come in and score well quicker than what someone like Dhoni did, and well quicker than everyone else, it was, I mean, I still remember the innings in South Africa, I think it was at the Wanderers, where he's just slapping the ball everywhere. And you're just like, what even is this, right? And Gilchrist comes around at exactly the same time. And again, you're talking about two one-offs within the team. You are not talking about a whole team doing this.
Yeah. And even if we move on to a more relevant comparison, of course, we've been talking about individual players thus far. But as you alluded to this earlier as well, I think it's the right time to bring it up. The Australian team of the early 2000s, they definitely played at a quicker rate than all other teams at that time. And, you know, they were striking it at over half a run more than the next best team in that era, which I think is quite commendable. And a lot of that was inspired by Adam Gilchrist, because he was gung-ho and he would come out and completely take the game away from you, much like Sehwag, but down the order. And the interesting part is that Gilchrist was the only batter in that entire team that was striking it at over 65, which I think is quite incredible, because that changes everything, right? Like, take Gilchrist out of that and maybe that Australian team as a whole would not be performing that same way. Whereas if you look at the Baz bowlers, you know, Stokes and McCullum and their boys, they're striking it at just under 5 in this time period that they've, you know, been a rejuvenated test unit. So I think that even though there is some sort of a comparison over there, would you say that like it's still very, very different what Australia did in the early 2000s to what England are doing now?
Yeah, so what Australia did, weirdly enough, the one thing I would say is that both of them are inspired by one-day batting. You hear a lot about, oh, England's, you know, baseball and T20. It's not really T20 if you look at it. What they're doing is very one-day inspired. And one-day cricket has changed, right? So from that perspective, it makes sense. What Australia were doing around that period was, we'll take Gilchrist out. I'll explain Gilchrist in a minute because he is a very important facet of this. You know, it would have been different to do this with Ian Healy at number seven, who is a fine chip it around sort of wicketkeeper and could counterattack, but not Gilchrist. What they basically did was early on, they knew that the fields would be up, right? And I think this probably comes back to when Slater was in the side originally, and he was, you know, Slater would attack. And you did get, you know, Gordon Greenidge is another player, Keith Stackpole. There would be occasionally be a Chris Shreekamp. There would occasionally be an opener that would come through whose theory would be, well, when all the field's up, I'm going to throw the bat at it because I'll get a bunch of boundaries early on. Then I'll be set, right? And then I can just bat normally. That was something that happened, but you could see those players would often slow down. So Australia took that on as a concept. You know, Langer wasn't really that kind of player. Australia kind of forced him into that role. He was an accidental opener there. Hayden was more naturally like that. You know, big strong guy, obviously a bit like, you know, someone like Zach Crawley. He could drive every ball that he wanted to drive just because he was so much taller than everyone else. He's been to Pakistan a lot. Have you ever stood next to Matt Hayden?
I've never stood next to Matt Hayden, but yeah, he looks like a huge unit.
Yeah, like he's put on a bit of weight recently, of course, but he's just big. He's just a big guy. And, you know, if you, you know, someone like KP, who's thought of as a tall batter, KP looks tiny next to Hayden, right? So you really start to understand that, you know, Hayden, Clive Lloyd's another person I've worked with in commentary before. And you like, you stand, and this is like, what, 75-year-old, 80-year-old Clive Lloyd. And you're still like, this is a big man, right? You know, and so Hayden was one of those sorts of batters, which we don't see that many of, right? And, you know, so from that perspective, you know, they had that start. Then they had Ponting coming in, right? So Ponting takes over at number three around that time. Ponting is a naturally attacking number three, you know, very Australian style number three. I'm going to put my stamp on this game in the way that Bradman and Ian Chappell did, you know, that very much that, you know, Neil Harvey maybe as well, maybe Harvey was a four, but that sort of, you might be bowling well, but I'm going to come at you so that I can knock you off a little bit. You then have, you know, the middle order players that they had, you know, so it would have been Steve Waugh at times, Mark Waugh, Damian Martin, those sorts of players. Darren Lehman, I think, was in that era as well, who scored quite
good. I mean, Michael Clark came about in, what, 2004?
Yeah, so Michael Clark comes around that time. All of those guys, fairly, they all have natural instincts. The only one who probably didn't was, by that point in his career, was Steve Waugh. Although Steve Waugh was a really attacking player when he was younger. But all those players, again, have one-day games as well, right? So they may not all be one-day stars, but they all have one-day games. And so the top order, what they basically do is they knock the field out, right? And then the rest of the team, what they do is they try and score just a little bit quicker than they normally would by taking singles, by running hard, by being fitter than everyone else, because that's what they'd done in 1987 to win the World Cup. And that's how their first revolution of one-day cricket is really through Australia chipping the ball into gaps, taking on the sweepers, running twos when other teams are running ones, right? And dropping the ball at their feet and taking singles. So Australia sort of take all that one day stuff and go, there's actually not that much risk in this, right? We should be able to score three singles and over without doing that much trouble. And by rotating the strike, what we'll do is put the bowler off a little bit more. When the bad ball comes, we'll hammer that away. When they put the sweepers out, we will just hit the sweepers. And eventually, that's how England stop it, right? England start to put, it's hilarious how far things have changed, but Michael Vaughan essentially invents sweepers, right? So up until that point, you didn't really put a sweeper out unless the team was absolutely caning you. You know, like one for 250 and you're like, okay, we're going to have to put out a deep point. We'll have to put out, you know, another guy on the leg side. We might have to put out a third in those days, you know, those sorts of fielding positions. Whereas Michael Vaughan in 2005 goes, well, the minute they start to hit boundaries, let's just put the sweepers out because they want to keep being attacking at this point for a little while and we'll put pressure back on them. They're going to have to make the decision. They're going to have to try and hit the ball harder or hit it to a different area they don't want to hit it to. So it's a very, very clever strategy and it comes about, Bayram, from essentially Australia were drawing test matches. And they were like, we are the best team in the world. Why are we drawing test matches? And it's really interesting going back to the West Indies. West Indies in, you know, the 70s and 80s and early 90s, absolutely the best team in the world. Have a look how many draws they played in, right? And part of that is their over rate, because they were taking like 17 hours to bowl an over at times. But a lot of it is that they couldn't work out how to crack this. And the Australians were very clever. They just went, okay, we're the best team. We're going to win the majority of games. But what we don't want to do is have a bunch of draws where we're the better team and we don't get a result out of it. That's frustrating for us. So if we score a little bit quicker, that will actually help us. And that's where it comes from. And there is a bump. And other teams tried it, but didn't really have the players around to be able to do that. Now, think about this. I remember asking Darren Goff once, who's the toughest bowler, a batter to bowl against, right? And remember, Sachin, Ponting, Lara, Steve Waugh, Inzi, like Dravid. You can go on and on. The players that he bowled against, you know, some of the greatest, you know, he would have bowled against Yunus Khan, right? All these guys. And he said it was Gilchrist. And I was like, right? Why? I said, because he couldn't have been the best batter. He said, no, but by the time you got to Gilchrist, you were in your second or third spell. The ball was probably, you know, the ball was probably old, or it was a second new ball, but you probably, you know, it wasn't brand new. So you weren't bowling to him ever with a brand new ball. You know, the conditions had changed. It was probably sunny in the middle afternoon. You didn't get to bowl to him in the morning or anything. And he would take my best ball and whack it. And I didn't, you know, because Goffey, for those who don't know, you know, not particularly tall, you know, more Wacker Yunus style of bowler, you know, skiddier, fast. He didn't have a second ball to be able to bowl to Gilchrist. And so when Gilchrist came out, they were probably already scoring at around 3.5 to 4 runs at over, right? So if every other team in the world scoring at 1.5 to 3 runs at over, right? And they're scoring at, you know, 3 to 3.5 to maybe even 4 and over, and then Gilchrist comes out, and then they have 200 runs on the board, 250 runs on the board, 300 runs on the board, 400 runs on the board. Gilchrist just is a completely different force at that point. And so they got the absolute most out of Gilchrist. Not, I think he could have batted up the order. I think he could have batted at 6 and given Australia an all-rounder if they'd felt more comfortable about Ian Harvey or Shane Lee or, you know, one of those sorts of all-rounders that were coming through. You know, they could have picked those sorts of guys, but they were just like, no, we have in McGrath, Gillespie and Warne, we basically have 3 of the 5 best bowlers in the world at any one stage. And what we're going to be doing at the other end is we'll pick whoever works for that particular surface. And when Gilchrist comes in, it's going to be when everyone is exhausted and he's going to tear them apart. So that's a very different from baseball, right? It's not so much attacking from taking huge risks. What they did was when the field was up, they would slash through point. You know, they would flick the ball off their pads. They would make sure that, you know, that they would take away. They didn't want you to bowl to them with 4 slips and a gully and a short leg. They wanted you to bowl to them with maybe 1 or 2 slips and a ring field, right? And they thought once they had that, they could then every now and again, they'd still be able to pick up their singles and twos. And then a really bad ball, they'd be able to pierce the ring field. And they were right. And they may, you know, they did start to win matches after. I mean, they broke the world record for the most wins in a row. Almost said it twice, I think, didn't they? You know, so they did everything they wanted to do. But the way I've just explained that to you, I think is vastly different to what we're seeing with baseball.
Yeah, no, absolutely. With baseball, you're seeing funky fields and reverse ramps, right? Yeah. And Joe Root playing those reverse ramps, which makes it all the more extravagant. But I think just to add to your points, especially on Gilchrist, I think Hobart 99 versus Pakistan is a very good example of, you know, the bowlers getting tired out and then Gilchrist going berserk. And Waz himself, I think he rates Martin Crowe as the best batter that he's ever bowled to. But I think Gilchrist is up there as well. And even though he's gotten him quite a few times, but still, Waseem has a lot of, you know, he keeps Gilchrist in a lot of high regard.
Yeah, so just on those, no, I just want to add to what you're saying. So those two first innings is really, really interesting what happens. He comes out and he makes, I want to say 79 or 80 in that first game. Shoaib gets in with an incredibly fast Yorker. I think that was at the Gabba. They go down to Hobart and Pakistan is in that game and in front of that game for, you know, huge periods of time. They end up sending Australia, was it 290 odd? Do you remember the total?
Something like that.
And
I've only seen highlights. I was 5.
And Australia lose 5 wickets early on. But Gilchrist, this is what comes back to that fast scoring mentality, because it's a really important point. And remember I said, sweepers didn't really exist in those days, right? One of my favorite innings is the Garfield Sobers one where he makes 250 odd at the MCG. And it just takes so long for them to put everyone out on the boundary. Whereas as a modern cricket fan, you're just like, oh my God, he's clearly going to hit everything to backward point. All right, he's going to pull everything and he's going to flick some balls to wide mid on. Just put out three guys and he will have to play differently. It takes it forever. Anyway, so the Gilchrist, what Wasim Akram does is, Gilchrist scores at such a high rate in that first test that even though Pakistan is well on top in that second test and should win that game easily, in fact, maybe they were chasing 350. Yeah, I think they needed about two.
Yeah, I think something over 300 maybe.
They needed around 200 runs, I think, when at five wickets down. So traditionally, you would lose that game. Wasim completely shits the bed on that, right? Because he just puts everyone out. And what he does is, without thinking, he basically gives Gilchrist a one-day field. And Gilchrist was a one-day player. It would have been much better off to actually give Gilchrist a test match field and put pressure on him a completely different way. But why does he do that? Because they hadn't come up against the Gilchrist before, right? There's no one really between Viv Richards, Gilchrist and Sehwag that scores that way. That doesn't mean there weren't attacking players, but there were players who would come out from ball one and be willing to hit you for four and six, right? That just wasn't a thing that we had in cricket beforehand, right? It's why Ben Stokes has set the record for the most sixes. It's why, Chris Gayle has the record for the sixes off the first ball. It's why Sehwag and Gilchrist have these incredible strike rates and why Baz Ball is happening now. These things don't happen that often. And that is a perfect example there of Gilchrist completely messing with the minds of the Pakistani players, because he was so explosive and so powerful and they didn't think about him as a normal test batter, right? And they were bowling beautifully. They were on top in that game. Pakistan should have won that game. Justin Lang and Nick behind him was given not out. So that obviously plays a big part in it. But Gilchrist makes like 150, right? 147.
Yeah. And I just checked. They scored 300, they were chasing 369. They got there. And while Gilchrist came out to bat when Australia were five down for 120 odd, they still needed more than 240 runs. So, I mean, that is amazing.
240, was
but
it?
Still.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, 240 from that point on. Yeah.
It was a ridiculous chase. And I remember being so confident from the moment Was put the field out. The minute he put the field out, I remember texting my friends. It was the birth of mobile phones was around that era. We all had mobile phones. And I remember texting my friends going, because they were like, game over. I went, I don't think so. I think Pakistan might have fucked up here. And, I mean, the optimism of that compared to what I then saw was, that was a little bit of fanboying or whatever. But you could see that he had changed the way that they were thinking about things. And so it was, that is still, everything we've just said is still very, very different to what Bazball is.
I mean, just the proof that you put down in your piece that 26 times in history has a team scored 300 plus runs in a test innings at a run rate of over five. And out of those 26 times, seven have been by England's Baz bowlers, which is phenomenal. And this Australian team that we're talking about, they only have one of those scores versus Zimbabwe. And I mean, there's so much more to this, right? I've obviously, taken note of the Baz ball shuffle ever since you pointed out in your piece. And a few people have said that, oh, but this is not new. People have been batting outside the crease for millennia or whatever. And this is something that Javed used to do or XYZ used to do. But hey, this is being done en masse, not That's just by the English boys. You've seen these tactics by the Australians as well. Khwaja was Baz ball or had employed the Baz ball shuffle at one point. Mitch Marsh was doing it. And the keepers are coming up to the stumps early on in the innings versus guys who are bowling 85 to 88 miles per hour. This is revolutionary.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live, because you shouldn't have to change teams even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto-renews.
Well, let's bring all this back together, because what you just said is very good. So Javed Mehndad did use the crease really well, right? He was an absolute genius at using the crease. And do you know how I know that? Because people talk about how well he used the crease. That tells me that everyone else wasn't using the crease like Jaffa Binda. Right? Because right now, as you've just named seven people. You could put Daryl Mitchell. You could put Tom Blundell in there. You could put most of Pakistan's top order in there at the moment. They're all doing it, right? 2 years ago, no one was leaving the crease, right? It was really rare to do that. And if you did bat out of your crease, it was because you were a player who batted out of their crease. It wasn't because you were a player who would then bat out of the crease, then bat back in their crease, and you wouldn't walk down the wicket. Who would walk down the wicket in Test cricket? And that goes back to the Gilchrist thing. I remember, Bayram, watching was put those fielders out, right? I couldn't believe it. Because who puts fielders out on the boundary when a guy first comes to the wicket? That didn't happen. Yeah. That wasn't something that happened in Test match cricket in 1999. If they started to hit some boundaries, maybe you might get that. If they were slogging, certainly that would happen. But not just when they first came out. There's a big difference between, and this goes back to the whole baseball phenomenon. Because this goes back to Sehwag. Sehwag playing attacking shots is not baseball. That's Sehwag just being Sehwag, right? That's Virat. Well, I shouldn't say it. I should do it in how Viru would say it. You know, Viru hit ball, right? Like, that's how he played, right? That is a big difference between an entire side. Like, one of my favorite things is Alex Lees. Alex Lees could barely hit the ball off the square when he came to Test cricket, right? And Baz had him going for it, right? Everyone was going for it, right? That's a huge change from just having naturally aggressive players or even doing what Australia did, which was a very controlled attacking style of, we will do this, then we will get on top, then we'll get on a roll, and then we'll throw Gilly in the end and he'll destroy worlds, right? That's a very different system. And what we are seeing now is, whether it be the baseball shuffle, whether it be just baseball batting in general, whether we see the way that England rotate through their plans. You know, when I covered England in 2010, 2011, Swan, Anderson, Broad, Tremlett, Brisbane, they would just bowl dry, right? They would bowl dry for hours, Bayram, if they had to, right? They would control the game for as long as possible, over and over and over again, and then eventually they'd attack when they took a wicket or two, and then they would try and get back into the game. Ben Stokes doesn't keep plans for more than about five overs now, right?
Yeah.
This is all the way through their game, and they've now got more plans. I think I put a checklist, might not have been in that article, might have been in the one the day before. That checklist, and they've got micro versions of that. I could, you know, do a more specific thing. They are just going, okay, plan A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. And when they get to the bottom, they just press repeat and they go back to the start again, right? This is not how cricket is traditionally played. Like, you know, West Indies would, you know, I mean, if you go back to that great Australian team we're talking about, Steve Waugh just kept five slips in. That was his big attacking move was not taking slips out, right? The West Indies, right? They basically, West Indies had two modes, back of a length and bounces. Right? They didn't really try that much else, right? They didn't ever try and get you to drive because they didn't want you to drive, right? They wanted to have their catches in the position they wanted. They wanted to protect their leg side boundary when they needed to and all that sort of stuff. Everything that England is doing is built on things that other teams have done, right? So the baseball shuffle does come from Javed Meander, right? Playing across the line and taking a risk, a calculated risk based on where the fielder is, comes from Victor Trumper, right? All these things are built up. And to give you the perfect analogy, it's like when music fans, like in the 90s, were suddenly like, wow, Nirvana have come through. And Nirvana, you know, we've never had a band like Nirvana before. And it's like, well, let's just slow down. Nirvana comes out of this sort of grunge era, right? There are other bands like Nirvana around at the moment. They're just not as good as Nirvana. But Nirvana doesn't exist without the Pixies. And you listen to the Pixies, and the Pixies say they don't exist without the Beatles. And the Beatles say they don't exist without rhythm and blues music, right? All these things have to come before you. But that doesn't mean that when you listen to Nirvana and you listen to the Beatles, that Nirvana isn't just an altogether different experience. And, you know, it doesn't mean that one's better than the other, because the Australian team that we were just talking about is still better than this English team. And I can't see any way that this English team is going to end up being as good as the Australian team or the West Indian team, right? They've just drawn a series at home against a good team, don't get me wrong, but they've just drawn a series at home, right? Have a look at Australia and the West Indies in their areas, right? Mm-hmm. There weren't anything like that. So that's not to say...
They were invincible.
Exactly. That's both of those teams the best just way to absolutely put it. Invincible, right? And so, you know, you have that situation where people don't always look back. And it's important to look back and go, actually, what they are building on and what they are coming up with, is, you know, there are building blocks all the way through that has led us to this theory. But also, it is really important to remember that this has never been done before. Right? That this is actually new, right? Yes, Trumper played his part and Viv maybe played his part and, you know, clearly Sehwag and Gilchrist and McCollum himself all played a part. But even so, McCollum didn't do this with his own teams. And the reason is that this is a specific team where he was given the freedom because of how shit England were before, right? They were just so terrible. He was given the freedom to essentially go, what are we good at? We're good at whacking the ball. Let's whack the ball. Let's have seven McCollums, right? And it's not quite seven McCollums. I'll explain why in a moment. But essentially, let's have, you know, five or six disruptors in every batting lineup, which means that the bowlers can't settle. And Ollie Pope does it by running down the wicket. And Zach Crawley does it by driving on the up. And Ben Duckett does it by not leaving. They're not all the same. They're, you know, all slightly different ways of doing it. And but what you actually need within that is then one superstar batter who can carry you through. And that was the thing they had from before, which is Joe Root. And all they've done to Joe Root is they've just taken him from test Joe Root to middle overs Joe Root, right? And I remember there were times when Joe Root was averaging 60 in the middle overs in one day cricket, right? Well, that's kind of what we're seeing now, right? His ability to score at a run a ball without taking risks that a normal human would have to take is... Can you think of anyone who's ever done it as well as Joe Root in the history of the game? At a run a ball without taking risks. I don't know if there's ever been anyone else. Like Virat's great, but Virat's usually slightly slower than a run a ball. Steve Smith, again, slightly slower. Kane.
Yusuf was good. Hey? Mohammad Yusuf was a good rotator of strike.
Yeah. What do you think his strike rate would have been, though?
In the middle overs? Fairly, like...
I reckon it would have been...
Maybe more than 60.
Yeah, I reckon it would have been slow. Right? I reckon it would have been, not slow, but I reckon it would have been at best around 65, 70, you know, 75. Whereas that's what I'm saying. It's the run a ball bit that I don't think we've ever seen anyone. And remember, England had kind of had three of them, really, because they had Owen Morgan. They also had Dawid Malan, who's not even as talented as the other two, but even he managed to do it. And you throw Joe Root into that, and then you've got Crawley and Duckett, which... Left hand, right hand, height disparity, the way they score could not be more different batters. It's phenomenally different, right? Like, I mean, the Langer Hayden one was a brilliant one for a similar sort of thing. But Langer and Hayden were at least both left handers. So you could eventually get into a rhythm against them. You know, you've got Ollie Pope probably being the quickest player to run down the wicket, you know, that maybe one of the most nimble with his feet against seam bowling that we've ever seen from that point of view. You know, then you've got Ben Stokes, who brings his own problem. Harry Brook, who hits the ball in areas that, you know, test players don't usually hit the ball in. You know, Johnny Bairstow, who once he gets on a roll, you know, then you've got, you know, Wokes and Moeen and maybe Sam Curran when he comes back in and all these. There's just so many little problems there. There still isn't great batters in that lineup, right? I've watched Zach Crawley in the last month be incredible. I haven't thought to myself, Zach Crawley is better than he was 2 years ago. There's still huge flaws within that. But what are they doing? They're maximizing what Zach Crawley can do. And that's what it is really about. And it's such a fascinating thing. And I just want to talk about the baseball shuffle very quickly because someone sent me an email. I think it was a former cricketer sent me an email recently saying that the England players are getting away with running down the pitch because Rishabh Pant obviously was told he couldn't do it in a game. And I don't think this person knew, but Keaton Jennings also got told off for taking his guard down. Modern players are, they're thinking about this so much now. They actually know where they can go. And partly that is down to what happened to Rishabh Pant and what happened to Keaton Jennings. So they've had these conversations. That's how methodical they're being. They're taking guard in a position that won't get them into the danger zone. And when they are running down the pitch, if you have a look at someone like Ollie Pope, he quite often, when he runs a long way down the pitch, he tries to get sort of outside the line of the ball. That's partly for LBWs. And Ben Stokes does that as well. But it's also because they know if they run down the middle of the pitch, they'll get done for running on the wicket. So that's how clever this all is at the moment. And, you know, to bring this all back, we had a bunch of years where the average against pace bowling was 25, 26, 27, 28. Mm. It's 34 at the moment, right? This isn't just England now. Everyone's worked out how to combat the wobble ball after years. But England are doing it in a way that is something else. And we're already starting to see Zimbabwe in one-day cricket. Mm. We're already starting to see Pakistan. And Bangladesh might be the biggest one, right? Bangladesh have two really fast innings. I had a look at this. There's a website. I can't remember the name of it. And there's a website. And all it does is track. Well, one of the main things it tracks is the fastest hundreds ever by a player, by country. I found it the other day when I was looking for all those stats. And it's really fascinating because, you know, it has a page of everyone who's made a 100 in Test cricket are better than a runner ball, right? And for each country, and you can click on it. Well, Bangladesh, there was hardly any, right? And you're looking at it now going, they might have three or four more of those guys in the next little while. And they won't be able to do it against the better teams all the time. But they're going to probably try it against Zimbabwe. May not work because of the quality of that bowling. They've already done it against Afghanistan. They've already done it against Ireland. They might do it against Sri Lanka if they feel the matchups work for them. I thought the biggest problem with all this is that England have Joe Root and that their white ball hitters were so much better than everyone else's, it was harder to replicate. Having seen the shuffle and having seen Pakistan, I think, is the other more interesting one, of playing to their strengths. Mm. I now get why a lot of teams could probably not replicate it, but have their own versions of it. If you go back, I'm not sure that was possible when Australia did it. I'm not sure at that stage on the kinds of wickets that we were playing on that you could hurry up Curly Ambrose, right? That you could, take on Wasim Akram, right? Now, it would be fascinating to see what we did do. And maybe Gilchrist proved that you could do it and we were all turning a blind eye to it and we thought he was a one-off. But the point is that these things have changed quite a bit and the game itself has changed and has allowed England to do that. But that doesn't mean that you can't give England their flowers because, oh my God, if you look at the run rate, you know, of them compared to world cricket at the moment, we've never seen a rise like this.
No, you definitely need to give them their flowers. And I think a lot of people struggle with that, right? People would have a problem with people coining it as, or you coining it as the Baz ball shuffle, because now it has the word Baz ball in it and people are probably sick of it. And I mean, there's the whole narrative going on. So maybe there's some just, you know, they don't want to give England that credit, but the truth is that they have revolutionized or are revolutionizing Test cricket.
No, that's a really good point. I wrote my book on Test cricket I can't remember, it must be from when they had an era in the early 50s where they had a lot of cutter bowlers, right? And then from about 1960 until 2010, England are just not a factor in Test cricket, right? If you look at the narrative, they don't invent anything, right? West Indies, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, New Zealand, Australia, all these different teams have great eras and flare-ups and invent things and move the game forward and, you know, have your Sehwags and your Gilchrists and your Kapil Devs and all these different fascinating sorts of things. England basically has Boycott, which was a fantastic player, Botham, right? And then they have a lot of good players that don't really change the needle in Test cricket. Alex Stewart could have, but failed as a wicketkeeper batter. He could have had the same impact that Gilchrist did, but he just, every time he had the gloves on, he couldn't make a run, right? Sadly. So it didn't work. Because England did try to change wicketkeeping batting twice before anyone else ever did, right? So if you look at my book on the history of Test cricket, The Unauthorized Biography, probably not available anywhere, but if it is, go find it. If you look at my book, you'll realize that England just fade out, right? They just fade out of cricket. And so when they come back in 2010-11 and they have what is a very good era, but a very short, very good era, and they go over the top because England cricket hasn't been important for so long, they get really excited. I think that's a natural, like, what? South Africa were just good for 7 years and you guys barely gave them any credit and you've had like two good years and you think suddenly you're brilliant and it's already fallen apart anyway. You know, your wicketkeeper can't walk anymore. Your spinner's elbow is buggered and Jonathan Trott's disappeared, right? And Strauss as well. Like they lost a lot of good players and they couldn't replicate it, right? Then you have this white ball revolution where for what? 2016, 2017, 2018, all those years, all everyone ever talks about is England white ball cricket. And what do they win? Fuck all. Right? They fail at every single hurdle. Now, people like me and Freddie Wilde, and we're like, guys, you have to trust this. What they're doing is so much better than everyone else. But if you're a normal cricket fan, you're like, stop talking about this team that can't play at big tournaments. Every time we see them at a big tournament, they don't do particularly good. We're not particularly interested, right? And so I think there is this, thing of, this is short, right? We're talking about the Australian period that I map with the, if we just go strike rates, is 6 years. But realistically, the Australian period of dominance is 12 years, right? And the West Indies period is what, 19 years, 17 years, right? This isn't going to last that long. All right, one way or another, something's going to happen. Either everyone does it, someone else does it better, or all these players age out. It's a bloody old team, right? You know, and we're not sure about all the young players. And we've already had one disappear. A couple more could go and everything else. And I understand that. Plus, the way the English media works, the way that the cricket media works between Australia, India and England, I think every fan in the world automatically hears, oh, there's a good young player from England. Me and Bharat have talked about this. Oh, Harry Brooks is really good. Okay, we're going to move him to here, right? Shubman Gill, we're going to move him to here. It's not that we don't think these guys are good. It's just that we're going to wait for them to be really good, right? Whereas actually, there are really good players from around the world that are really good that no one will talk about, right? And so that's how we do things. And I think there's a lot of fans who feel that way. All of that is, and this before we get to colonization and all the other nonsense and spirit of cricket, right?
Right. Moral ashes.
Moral ashes, all that sort of stuff. I understand all of that. As someone who is, you know, is an Australian who's thrust in, who writes about the global game and is, you know, not as much these days, but in the old days, terminally online sort of person, right? But right at the moment, you can't look at what they're doing and not put it into the proper context and pretending that like one-off guy did it or that Australia did this before or anything else, it's fundamentally not true. And
there's so much more to it, right? It's not just the attacking cricket and, well, high-risk cricket, which, by the way, is starting to come to them as second nature now. When Joe Root reverse ramps, it seems like a safe shot. And I actually asked Ben Duckett when he was reverse sweeping a lot in Pakistan that, you know, when you play the reverse sweep, do you think of it as a high-risk shot? And he said it's like forward defense for me. So what they're doing is infectious. We're seeing the impact it's having, not just with the attacking cricket, but with the shuffle, of course. And you mentioned Pakistan. They played with a bucket load of intent versus Sri Lanka, very differently to how they used to play, well, maybe a couple of years back. India went absolutely ballistic in one innings versus the West Indies.
Their fastest ever score over 250 in Test cricket history, I think.
Something like that. No, I think they had declared at 180 or something.
Oh, maybe it was their fastest score over 35 overs or something. Whatever it was, it was the fastest score that they'd ever had before, yeah.
Yeah, and you quoted Bangladesh as well. So you add the funky feels to this and all those different ideas that Ben Stokes has, and it's always changing with England. I mean, there's so much more to this story. Bazball is not just attacking cricket, and it's impacting cricket in different ways that you, actually, in your piece, mentioned that West Indies playing four quicks in the 70s and 80s, that might have been the most disruptive thing to ever happen to Test cricket. Do you think Bazball trumps that?
That's a really interesting question, because I remember when Bazball first started, my biggest thought was, I didn't think other people could replicate it, right? And that's the thing with the four fast bowlers. Great, that's a great idea. We should all do that. Oh, we don't have four fast bowlers, right? Yeah. Like, it's all well and good to say, oh, what we should do is, you know, pick Joel Garner and Malcolm Marshall and Annie Roberts and, you know, Curtly and Courtney and Ian Bishop and all the, you know, Sylvester Clark and Colin Croft. Well, when you've got, listen to the names I've just said, right? Like, I always say that, you know, the West Indies assistant coach, Roddy Eswick, never got anywhere near the test team and has a first-class bowling average of 21, right? Like, these guys were ridiculous. And I thought that the thing, that why that changed cricket so much is it correlates with the helmet era, although they were a big part of why people got helmets quicker, but that was also, you know, Australia had started to do that and even England had started to bowl more bounces at that point. But it correlates with the harder pitch era, the helmet era. And cricket goes from a swing seam bowling to seam. And the lengths completely change. And the way that you attack when you're bowling completely changes. So that if you watch cricket in the 80s and 90s, it didn't look like cricket in the 50s and 60s, right? And if you, from that point of view, West Indies changed everything. So Glenn McGrath, right? Stuart Broad, you know, Mornay Morkel, all these guys come out of that West Indies school, even if they don't know that they come out of that. Andy Caddick, right? Because you go from these sort of pitch up Matthew Hoggard type bowlers to these back of the length kind of bowlers. And so that changes everything. It makes batting a lot more of a physical task, right? Because you're now facing bowlers that are, you know, in the old days you were facing guys who didn't have to be that fast because they were swinging the ball so much. Now everyone's fast, right? So you've got the courage aspect goes up, facing multiple bouncers goes up, all that. That is a huge, huge change. But Australia didn't pick four Glenn McGraths because they still couldn't find four Glenn McGraths. Because of T20 cricket, because of one-day cricket, because of the franchise structure of everything, I do wonder if it is slightly more replicable for other teams than I originally did. As I said, originally I was like, England's the best white ball team in the world. It makes sense for them to play red ball cricket in a white ball style.
It also comes down to player utilization. Like England have those players who can go at that rate. Other teams may not. But again, like Pakistan, you've got a lot of these guys who can play run a ball and play risk-free cricket at a good
rate. And I think that was the bit I think when we first saw it, and everyone did this, myself included, we were sort of more thinking T20. Whereas now I'm looking at going, well, Rizwan and Babar Azam could be the best baseball players outside of England because they should be able to just bat forever at run a ball because they do bat forever at run a ball, right? and you know, Safraz would be another one. Shaan Masood could be another one. And you're just like, well, wait a minute. Now, they've got four guys, right? And they could bring in some attacking, Harris could come in or, you know, whatever, you know, just go, okay, we'll throw Harris into the mix of that and see what he does. And, you know, he goes ballistic or whatever, or whoever else is you know, in that sort of play. And I think that's the bit that I didn't see coming. So from that point of view, it might be that it is a bigger impact on world cricket because more teams can try it and be successful at it. And I think watching Test cricket right at the moment, if you look at, as I said, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan and England, and I think Zimbabwe will probably try and play the same way if they can. I don't know how many Test matches they've played recently on good pitches, but I think they'll try and play a similar way listening to how Dave Houghton's been talking. That's five teams who are going to go for it, right? If that's the case and we see that, then that will be a bigger shift than what the West Indies did. However, I still think, you know, that generally the shift that the West Indies did was maybe more dramatic in changing the game from one style of cricket to another. But I don't know. It's a really, really interesting question that you ask because we, in those days, things changed slowly because things changed slowly, right? So for instance, you know, I think I might have written about this in the Stuart Broad piece, but the birth of the wrongen is really interesting. And sadly, we can't go back and, well, I might be able to do it with maybe someone like Crick Viz or Zed Stats, but I'd love to go back and see what the wrongen did because essentially, you know, a very quick story here. A English person invents the wrongen. He's got a friend who's English who goes off to play cricket in South Africa. He teaches four of his club teammates, provincial teammates, and some of them were club players, how to bowl the wrongen. Right? Aubrey Faulkner is one of them. But there's four of them all together. Reggie Swartz is the guy's name. And they win their first ever series, having never won a series before, where I think a huge percentage of the wickets were taken by leg spin / the wrongen. It gets to the point at which people in their 1920s start to talk poorly of the wrongen because it's ruining cricket. Right? But this takes ages. I think it takes 7 years for the South Africans to bowl it, and for about 7 or 8 years it's one English person bowling it, right? If that happened now, look at the wobble ball. That was even before the kind of YouTube era that we now live in and the close-up highlights era. That essentially takes about 4 years to start to spread and 7 years to completely take over the game and change the way that everyone bowls, right? The knuckleball was even quicker, right? And, you know, the leg cutter was another really fascinating one in T20 cricket. These things happen so quickly that you'll go from, I'll turn up at a T20 tournament the year later and I'll have all these notes on these players and they'll have changed all their slow balls.
Yeah, if you go to the early 2000s, remember when the back of the hand slower one became a really popular delivery? It took time. It wasn't very, very quick, right?
Would like, you want to know when that started? Start to
see when did that start? Was it Steve Waugh?
No, it wasn't Steve Waugh. Simon O'Donnell. So Simon O'Donnell comes into the Australian team around 1984, 85. Wow. Bayram, right? And you're right.
Well, there you have it.
It takes about 10 to 15 years to push its way through the entirety of the game. The best one is probably the Dusra. There's an Australian cricketer who bowls the Dusra in the 60s, right?
And
who
would even... I did not know that.
He was an Oxford cricket coach for years. And he was a part-timer. And Richie Beno was saying to him, what are you doing? Forget about your batting. You could bowl off spin and this other ball that no one else could ever bowl before, right? This guy didn't even, it didn't even do anything with it, right? And it's the same with, we've got cases of the reverse sweep happening, I think, in the late 1800s, right? Things took a long time to blend through the game, right? And now, it's like, I'm writing notes of how England are batting differently in the crease. And by the time I've looked it up, Pakistan are doing it. Yeah. Right? It's that quick now. And it's only, and that's what is happening over and over again. And so from that perspective, even if the England changes aren't as dramatic as what the West Indians did with how they changed cricket, it could be far quicker and more widespread just because that's how the game works now.
Yeah. I mean, there is, of course, that narrative that England themselves have pushed so much so that people have gotten sick of it, that England are saving Test cricket. Yeah. Well, they might saving Test cricket.
I think it's okay
cricket.
To make fun of them for that, though, right?
And they might not
If you're
be.
Losing a fucking Test match and going on about how you played the better cricket, no one gives a shit, mate, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because your job is to win the game. And as I've just said, in a couple of years, everyone will change. And this is the other thing I would say. Between 2019 and 2022, we had some of the greatest Test matches ever played. There was some great cricket. You know, the Border Gavaskar Trophy was played in that period, right? There was some fantastic... Yeah. We had the Kusal innings. We had the Stokes innings. Stokes in 2019 wasn't saving Test cricket, but Harry Brook flapping around at short balls is. Let's just pump the brakes on that a little bit, right? I think it's okay to make fun of them. But sorry, I completely stood on you there.
No. I mean, I was just going to end things by saying that the moral of the story over here is that they might not be saving Test cricket, but they are introducing a new genre to it. They have made it more entertaining and they are having an impact. So the revolution is very much on because it's impacting different teams in different ways. And you can't just ignore baseball and shit on it because you don't like England. That's not fair. And I guess that's a good place to end this, I suppose, Jared, because we've gone way over time. But, I mean, it's just one of those topics, I suppose. Thank you to everyone who tuned in. We'll be back next week with Footmarks Episode 12. We hope that you liked this one. Thank you for your time as well, Jared. That'll be all for now. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Senapayu and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content.
Sports Social Podcast Network.